CNN Radio, I'm Bill Caiaccio. Top story, Shane Bauer and Josh Fattal should be back on American soil soon. They met briefly with reporters before getting on a plane in Oman. Bauer says it's been an unforgettable few days since they were released from prison in Iran.
Getting off the plane that brought us here 3 days ago was the most incredible experience of our lives. We'll never forget the excitement of seeing our loved ones waiting for us at the foot of the plane.
Bauer and Fattal are scheduled to arrive at New York's JFK Airport. President Obama blasted Republicans during a speech to the Congressional Black Caucus.
How about doing something real for job creators? Pass this jobs bill, and every small business owner in America, including 100,000 black-owned businesses, will get a tax cut. You say you're the party of tax cuts? Pass this jobs bill.
The president urged African Americans to join with him to do something about creating jobs and opportunity. The unemployment rate for blacks is close to 17%. Businessman Herman Cain won a Republican presidential straw poll in Florida by a wide margin. CNN's Peter Hamby explains why Cain did so well.
It's hard to find a Republican that doesn't like Herman Cain. They might not think he's qualified to be president, but they like Herman Cain.
Texas Governor Rick Perry was a distant second. Bad beef was headed for children in Georgia. About 40,000 pounds of ground beef intended for school lunches have been recalled because of possible E. coli contamination. Barcelona will host its last bullfight today before a ban goes into effect. CNN's Nadia Bilcek reports bullfighting is not what it once was in northeast Spain.
And so many young Spaniards are saying, this shouldn't be part of our culture anymore. Look what happens to these bulls. Is this what we want to be synonymous with? Not only is the bull lanced in the ring, but prior to him going in the ring, some matadors say they actually put Vaseline jelly in the eyes.
For news anytime, go to CNN.com. This is CNN Radio.
On to round three. If a train leaves Spokane...
Schenectady by Saturday!
Correct. March comes before May. What's in my left pocket?
Half a mint and a rusty switchblade!
Correct.
Bam!
Who lets you watch TV episodes and movies instantly over the internet?
Ha-ha! Netflix!
Correct! Watch unlimited TV episodes and movies for only $8 a month from Netflix! See terms of use.
That is rad!
I know. Can you put me down now?
Sorry, I'm a hugger.
Nursery looks great. Glad we got that personal loan from OneMain Financial. And the loan specialist said we have options if our situation changes.
Honey, twins.
Twins?
City Financial is now OneMain Financial. Still providing personalized loan solutions. Go to OneMainFinancial.com or call 1-855-321-MAIN. OneMain Financial. Your needs, your goals, your dreams. Offer subject to restrictions and requirements of the licensee. For licensing information, visit our website or call us.
There is a watchmaking standard that is revered around the world. That standard comes from Rolex. From clasp to bracelet to its unique watertight oyster case, a Rolex holds its value because it was intended to. Crafted from just three precious metals, platinum, steel, and gold, each defies the ordinary. Its steel, 904L, virtually indestructible and corrosion resistant, is incomparable. Its patented Everrose Gold, created in an exclusive foundry, will remain beautiful for life. Inside, a genuine Rolex movement is a product of superiority and remarkable testing. It is unrivaled. At Rolex, flawless standards create more than a watch. They create a value that was meant to endure. For a complete selection of Rolex timepieces, visit your official Rolex jeweler.
See what a new watch can say about you at Tourneau, the world's largest watch store since 1900. Tourneau, the fashion center at Pentagon City, Arlington.
The price of gas was really taking its toll on my wallet.
Oh, hey, Shelly.
So, to save some money, I've started taking the bus that sort of goes by my office.
Mom, stop talking. You're embarrassing me.
Did I mention it's my daughter's school bus? There, I just did. Hey, a penny saved.
Stop it.
Penny earned.
There's an easier way to save. Get online. Go to Geico.com. Get a quote. 15 minutes could save you 15% or more on car insurance.
Computers are a wonderful tool, but every day children are sexually solicited online. Protect your kids online. Visit CyberTipLine.com. Help delete online predators.
Hi, I'm Congressman Jerry Connolly. I want your children to be safe online. Talk with your kids about online safety. Know who is communicating with your child.
This message brought to you by the National Association of Broadcasters and this station.
This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Executive Leaders Radio. In this hour, you'll hear directly from our region's finest business leaders. Through each of the interviews, these high-achieving leaders become relatable role models who share how they were able to build their enterprise, their personal secrets of success, about leadership styles, and opportunities that lie ahead. Prepare to be inspired, entertained, and to hear wisdom unheard elsewhere. Executive Leaders Radio.
You're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce. And this is your host, Peter Schwartz, along with my co-host, David Cooper with the Bank of America, and Phil Horegi with Sabre Systems. We have a great lineup of guests on our show today, including Edgar Dobie, who's the managing director of Arena Stage, Jim Martinko, the co-managing partner of the Bethesda office for the Resnick Group, Steve D'Antonio, chairman and CEO of Color Me Beautiful, Inc., and finally, Bassam Mansour, who's the president of Michael & Sons. Joining us first is Edgar Dobie, who's the managing director with Arena Stage. What is the Arena Stage, Edgar?
The Arena Stage is a 61-year-old company that's earned the right to be called the Mead Center for American Theater. We produce, we present, we develop, and we study the best in American theater. And we just opened a brand new $135 million three-theater production and performance complex in the Southwest, right on the waterfront. And we opened it on time, on budget. And I'm happy to report that we're about 10% ahead of what our occupancy load was for the first year, and had a small surplus.
Congratulations! Surplus. When was Arena Stage founded?
It was founded 61 years ago by Zelda Fitchhandler, Tom Fitchhandler, her husband, and Ed Magnum, who was a professor of theater at George Washington University.
And you mentioned it's the resident theater movement. They started the resident theater movement. What is that?
Right. Well, 60 years ago, the only place that you could see live theater in a lot of the major cities was in the roadhouses. And in Washington's case, that was the National Theater. And that was all imported work. It was rehearsed and created in New York, largely, and then toured around the country. For Zelda and for a lot of people in Washington, it was important to have the theater created in the community itself by the artists who live in the community. So Arena Stage was founded. One of three. There was a theater company in Houston, and there was a theater company in Providence, Rhode Island. From that early days of there being the three, Arena led the way, and there are now nearly 2,000 resident theater companies in North America.
So you've been in the business for quite a while. What would you say separates the Arena Stages from the National Theater?
Well, we create the work here. In D.C.,
So because of companies like yours, local actors can have jobs.
Local actors have jobs. Importantly, writers. When Arena was founded 60 years ago, writers that are really familiar to your ear now, probably Arthur Miller, Edward Albee, writers like that, were only getting their start. We're able now to foster a lot of writers' work, and in fact, we continue to be pioneers as a company. We introduced a program called the Resident Theater Writer. We've actually have five writers who are our employees, who have health care, who have all of those things that you normally think an artist has to give up.
How big or small is Arena Stage today?
We're an annual operating budget about $20 million. We employ 153.
153 people.
Yeah. Well, it's three theaters. We're a year-round operation. We produce 11 shows a year. We have a subscription membership base of nearly 15,000 people.
Wow. And when did you join the organization?
I joined 2 years ago.
In the role of managing director?
In the role of managing director.
So why were you the ideal pick at the time?
Well, I think I was available to begin with, and I had about.
This is not the place to be modest. Why were you the ideal pick at the time?
Yeah, I've been doing this. This is all I've ever done is worked in the theater, and I've only ever been in a managing director or a producer role. I've worked worked in both the public and the commercial theater, so I had the kind of experience and knowledge and the kind of passion that you need to join
but
a place like that.
I understand this. The search for your role took 13 months.
It did.
What was it about you that made you the ideal selection, you think? Looking back on it, what did you have that the others didn't have?
I think I had the experience in the in dealing with big operational issues. At one point in my career, I was running Andrew Lloyd Webber's really useful company, and had 13 or 14 productions running across North America. So you need that kind of experience to.
Well, with all that experience, why were you interested in the job?
In the job here. Because it has arena has a really important place in the history of this community and the history of this country, and like any human being, you like to feel that you're leaving a legacy, you're making a difference, and there's an opportunity to make a big difference at Arena Stage.
Did you find coming in 2 years ago with the economy the way it was rather daunting though?
It was daunting, as it was. Our new building was a $135 million project. And it was the decision to go ahead and build was made in early 2008, and we all know what happened around then. So we were right on the cusp of probably another month later in making that decision, and the financing and the funding and the bond issue probably wouldn't have succeeded. So we were lucky there, and anyone needs luck, right, in life, and Arena certainly had that. But you make your own luck, and we have a very, the way we're governed is that we have a board of directors, and that board of directors was passionate about getting this project done.
So where in your background would you look to say that helped prepare you for this kind of a monumental task to pull together $135 million to get this magnificent building built?
Well, to get it built, and, My main challenge was it was well under construction. It was a 2.5 year construction project. During that time, we left the Southwest and set up in 5 separate locations in Crystal City, down in the U Street corridor, and then offices and production facilities spread out across the greater Washington area. So, when you're producing a show or leading a company, you've got to be able to pull all of those pieces together.
So where are you from?
I'm a Canadian by birth, but I moved here directly from Providence, Rhode Island, but ran a production company in New York.
Uh-huh.
If you've heard of a show called Riverdance,
sure.
I was involved with River Dream Productions.
What were Mom and Dad doing when you were growing up?
My dad was a small businessman. Had a few businesses. His most... The one that I remember the most was his being involved with and a partner in a GM franchise. So he's a small businessman, and he ran the product support side of that. So the customer, the service, and my mother was a telephone operator who became very involved in the telecommunications union organizing.
Wow, pretty diverse backgrounds. How do you suppose that shaped you to be the person you are today?
Well. The theater is a, there's no question about it, it's a people, artist, it's bringing artists, and I like to say it's impossible to do it, because think about it, you convince these actors to come and rehearse and arrive and deliver a performance 8 times a week at a specific time. You also, in our case, when we have all three theaters operating, we have we convinced 1,200 people to somehow navigate through their day to get there. And in order to do that, you've got to be able to really motivate people. And my mother and my father were a great example on how to motivate
people. So you learned that from them.
Yeah.
That's great.
Hey, you're 35 years in this business. That's a long time, yet it stays fresh for you. How do you keep it that way?
It stays fresh because every day is different. When you're in the commercial theater, you tend to get one project. But in the case of Really Useful Company, we had 15 different shows running. And each one of those is a business. It's a family. It's a community that has its own problems. And as an executive leader, you have to deal with those. So every day is a fresh set of problems.
You had an interesting comment in the green room that theater has such an integral participatory role in helping communities thrive. What do you mean by that?
Well, listen, we work hard. All of us in this nation work hard, and we're involved in protecting a way of life that we have here. Central to that quality of life, I think, is celebrating what's in our culture, and one of the more generous things we do as human beings is sit down and tell each other stories, whether it's around a family dinner table or in a big Broadway theater with a big Broadway musical or in the intimate spaces that we have at Arena Stage. So, you know, that's vital. That's part of what makes communities. Theaters are on their own plot of ground.
What makes that so important to you?
To me, it's a way to demonstrate that you can make a difference in the quality of a community's life.
What's your proudest moment been up till now?
Proudest moment up till now was, I have to say, leading this Arena Stage staff and trustees through to a hugely successful first opening season in this new theater. We had over 15,000 people come on our open homecoming day, made up of disparate groups from the community, including our own staff alumni. There were over 400 people who came just to the staff alumni brunch. And then to open the season with Oklahoma and have it be a huge, huge success, embraced by the community. And every single artistic decision that we made, we they were smart decisions to begin with, and they were extremely well executed. So seeing a team come together
Wonderful. And
do a good job is pretty satisfying.
Great. What's the website address?
www.arenastage.org.
Thank you. We've been speaking with Edgar Dobie, who's the managing director of Arena Stage. I'd like to thank my co-host, David Cooper with the Bank of America, and Phil Horegi with Sabre Systems. Don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, to learn more about our executive leaders. We'll be back in a moment right after this business spotlight. This is Peter Schwartz with Vistage International, and this is your business spotlight. Joining us today is
Larry Dressel.
Larry, what company are you with?
Centric Telecom.
What is Centric Telecom?
At Centric Telecom, we sell, install, and maintain Toshiba telephone systems to small and medium-sized organizations, not only throughout this area, but countrywide for our current customer base.
What makes your business different?
One of the key items that makes our business different is service. Because we only handle one platform, the Toshiba platform, that allows us to provide a much higher level of service than other companies selling telephone systems.
What about your employees? What makes them special?
Oh, I have great employees. First of all, the longevity. I've owned the business now for 7 years, and the average length of employment for my 9 employees is 5.5 years. And the expertise and the service mentality that they have is just great.
How do you define success, Larry?
In a number of different ways. First of all, by having a happy, satisfied, and growing customer base. That is one of the key items. The second item is to have happy employees and providing good service. And finally, to have a profitable bottom line.
And are you just into the equipment, or do you offer other things as well?
No, we offer other things as well. Not only the Toshiba platform for organizations anywhere from 4 people to a couple thousand at multiple locations, but also we do voice and data cabling as well as the network side of things, voice and data circuits.
Wonderful. How can someone reach you?
There are various ways to reach us. First of all, we're on the web, www.centrictel.com. We're on Facebook, and of course, you can always call us at 703-321-5070.
Thank you. We've been speaking with Larry Dressel, who is the president and owner of Centric Telecom. This is Peter Schwartz, and that's been your Business Spotlight. We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from the Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce. This is your host, Peter Schwartz, along with my co-host, David Cooper, with the Bank of America, and Phil Horegi with Sabre Systems. Joining us for this segment is a young man by the name of Jim Martinko, who's the co-managing partner of the Bethesda office for the Resnick Group. What is the Resnick Group?
Resnick Group is a top 20 national accounting firm. We're headquartered in Bethesda, Maryland. We were formed in 1976 and primarily got our start in expertise in affordable housing and other tax-incentivized investments in real estate. We took that real estate expertise to a national level. Today we have 10 offices across the country, about 1,500 professional staff, and numerous other practice areas outside of affordable housing and real estate.
And how long have you been with the firm?
22 years.
22 years.
Second job out of school. I started with another national firm. I was there for 3 years. I didn't like the culture. I had an opportunity to come to Resnick. I actually followed my girlfriend there, who's my wife today, and been married to her for 18 years, and I've been at Resnick for 22 years. Two success stories.
And you became co-managing partner when?
About 6 years ago. I stepped into that role from a client service role previously, running a book of business, traveling all over the country. I exceeded some metrics that we have, and they gave me the opportunity. And it's a real testament to the firm to allow leadership transition to the next generation, and that's one of the reasons why I've stayed at Resnick Group for so long.
Yeah, we'll get to the transition in a minute, but okay. Why the heck would anybody want to work 80 hours a week?
Exactly.
We're dying to know.
When I started, it was easy. You worked 3.5 months out of the year, and you took the summer off. That's what they tell you. And I didn't know how to ski, but I loved the beach, and I loved the summer. So that's how I got into the business. Today, it's not like that. We don't have near the 70 to 80-hour work weeks. But I stayed in accounting not because it's a numbers game. It's a people's game, and I like working with people, helping people. And I'm pretty good at math, too.
I wouldn't expect to hear that from an accountant. I would expect to hear it's about the numbers.
Yes.
What is it about the people?
Well, it's implied that people in my profession are technically competent. And it's the way that you deliver your services that makes people feel comfortable in being their trusted advisor.
Talk a little bit more about that, the way that you deliver the services, specifically how in your case.
It's all about developing a team under you. We use a leverage model in our firm. So the more that we can pass down experiences, recommendations, and teach people the way to handle their clients with trust and respect, the more that we're able to organically grow our practice.
Jim, can you just, you've been with the firm for 22 years, so you were there for, I won't say from the beginning of the firm, but certainly during the firm's early days. How has it changed, in the 22 years? I mean, obviously, you're almost considered, like, I guess, a national firm now.
We're a national firm now. When I first came to the firm, we were a regional firm just in Bethesda, Baltimore, and Charlotte, I believe. I came in 1990, which was the first recession that I've been associated with, and it was also a time where the real estate tax law had just changed. So really what had happened in the early part of my career, which gave me the opportunity to grow, was explosive growth from 1995 to 2000 with tax incentivized investments in real estate, specifically the low-income housing tax credit. And we pushed that expertise nationally, and just 20% growth a year was phenomenal.
Yeah, I remember you saying part of the reason why you've been with this firm for 22 years was because of the affordable housing link.
Absolutely.
What was that impact on you to watch that go on?
So when you're in accounting coming out of school, affordable housing is not sexy. You want to work on Wall Street. You want to work for the publicly traded companies. But when you go to these properties and you see the types of people that are living in these properties, And you sit back and you understand that you're providing a service to enable housing and other benefits to people who otherwise wouldn't be able to have a decent place to live. So for me, it was very rewarding. And for my entire company, it's very rewarding to give back to the community in such a big way.
Jim, you're one of these rare commodities in the Washington area, and that you're a native of the area. Can you talk to us a little bit about your family background?
Yes, I was born at Holy Cross Hospital, and I've been here my entire life. I graduated from Albert Einstein High School in Montgomery County, and also a graduate from the University of Maryland in 1986.
What were you like as a kid?
Very entrepreneurial, grass cutting business. When I was 10 years old, my best customer paid me $15 a yard, which was a lot of money back then. I tried the paper route thing, but that didn't work out. I worked at White Flint Mall when it first opened up in a soup and salad place, which wasn't the best place to give free food to my friends. I've always had a job. The good thing is that I liked it because I always had a couple dollars in my pocket.
And why accounting? What got you started there?
I was good at math. My father helped me keep track. Actually, I believe it was my mother who helped me keep track of all of my money that I was making. But I was good at math. There was a teacher, God rest her soul, Miss Topchick, that was my first exposure to accounting. And ironically enough, like I said before, everybody thinks accounting is all about the numbers, and that's why I initially got into it. But what I found is it's more about the people more than anything else. It's not about the numbers.
Talk about your transition from accountant to leader.
Primarily as an accountant, your main responsibility is servicing your clients. So you're helping them with their problems, and you're training and developing the staff that work on the accounts. When you transition into more of a leadership role within the firm, your clients are your partners. And no disrespect meant to my partners, but my clients are a little easier to manage than my partners are.
Well, yeah, can you talk a little bit more about that? I guess, coming from a consulting practice, you know, where you had a book of business and dealing with clients, to maybe the different types of challenges that there are being a co-managing partner, you know, how are the problems different?
Sure. It's more looking at the strategy of the firm, looking at how the different types of things that we believe are growth areas for the firm, looking at our HR functions, looking at our marketing functions, and looking more internally to our problems and planning our future as compared to the similar things with our clients or external.
So you've been at it for 22 plus years. What's changed?
Much more technology.
How has technology influenced the accounting industry?
When I got started, one of the sacrifices I had to make when I saw what was in front of me, 70-hour work weeks, 150 days a year on the road, always in an airport because we had this national practice, lugging audit bags all over the place. Now everything's paperless, and you don't need to visit a client site anymore, which is a little unfortunate because you miss that interaction. That's different, and we see the people coming out of school. This year, in a couple of weeks, we have 50 new people coming into our office. They're much more focused on the social element of how we give back to the community. So the idea of affordable housing. In 2 weeks, we have a community work day on the National Mall. They really get into that, and they demand us to be socially responsible to our community.
Jim, you talk a little bit about where some of your entrepreneurial spirit came from. You were good with numbers, but then you were also good with people. And that's not something you typically learn in school. But where did it come from?
Certainly, growing up, I enjoyed being very independent. I'm the youngest of four, and there was a bit of an age difference between myself and my older brother. So I was very independent, and I liked being in control, and I liked to have some money in my pocket to treat my girlfriends or treat my friends or really to do whatever I wanted to. And I was fortunate enough to have a personality where people liked me, so they gave me opportunities. With my work ethic, I did a good job, and I kept on getting referrals, whether it be in my grass cutting business or today in business.
What were Mom and Dad doing growing up?
My parents grew up in Youngstown, Ohio, and they were the first to move out of the area to start our family here in Montgomery County. So very hardworking, very modest means, didn't go to college. But that taught me a lot of good life lessons.
What'd your dad teach you?
Actually, my father taught me the benefit of complimenting women on their shoes. He was actually He got his start, and he transferred to Montgomery County, Maryland from Youngstown, Ohio, to accept a manager position with Baker Shoes back in the day.
And so does that actually work?
I believe so. My uncles, my father passed away a number of years ago, and my uncles always used to tell me that my father got all the girls because he used to compliment them on their shoes. So give it a try.
I think I will. What's been like to lead through the past 4 years of a severe recession?
Without question, the hardest day of my life from a work experience was a day 3 years ago when we had to lay off 46 people in our office in Bethesda. I think nationwide it was about 10% of our professional staff. But the way that our business works is we hire people full, sometimes 2 years, 18 months in advance of their start date. And so the people that started with us that fall, we actually hired 2 years ago, and we had absolutely no idea what was ahead of us. So that was certainly one of the hardest days in my professional career. And I'm glad to say that we're back to hiring the same level of people that we were hiring 3 and 4 years ago.
Right. What's the website address, Jim?
The website is www.resnickgroup.com.
Thank you. We've been speaking with Jim Martinko, who's the co-managing partner of the Bethesda office for the Resnick Group. I'd like to thank my co-host, Dave Cooper, with the Bank of America, and Phil Harrigi with Saber Systems. Don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, to learn more about our executive leaders. We'll be back in a moment right after this business spotlight. This is Peter Schwartz with Vistage International, and this is your Business Spotlight. Joining us today is
Sophie Pyle.
And Sophie, who are you with?
I am with Vox Worldwide.
What is Vox Worldwide?
Vox Worldwide is my company. I do social media maintenance for a variety of different clients.
Social media maintenance. What the heck is that?
Yes. So maybe a company doesn't want to have their marketing person working full time on their Facebook and Twitter accounts, which are very important today that every business have one. So what I do is I maintain their Facebook and Twitter accounts and also try to optimize other tools so that they are getting the most out of today's social media programs.
How long have you been in business?
I've been in business since I graduated college in 2009, and it's been booming. People love the internet.
You started a business right out of college?
Yes.
How's it going?
It's going well. It took a lot of struggles in the beginning, but I learned a lot. It's hard having your own business.
Is there a particular success story you can reference?
Yes. My biggest client acquisition yet so far has been guestofaguest.com, which is owned by Cameron Winklevoss of the famous Winklevoss twins, and Rochelle. She's a wonderful boss up in New York is where it's grounded, but I'll be doing a lot of coverage of Fashion's Night Out tonight in Georgetown, so I'm really excited about that.
Mm-hmm. Why should companies be considering social media as a part of their strategy?
It's another excellent marketing tool that's relatively inexpensive. It can be free if you have the right tools and the right things in place, so something that every business should have.
Uh-huh. And if someone wanted to get a hold of you, how could they reach you?
They can reach me at Vox Worldwide, VOXWorldwide.com.
Great. This is Peter Schwartz with Vistage, and this is we've been speaking with Sophie Pyle, who's the CEO of Vox Worldwide, and this has been your Business Spotlight. We're back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio, broadcast from Fairfax County Chamber of Commerce. This is your host, Peter Schwartz, and along with my co-host, David Cooper with the Bank of America, and Phil Harrigi, Ed Allaire with Buchanan, Ingersoll, and Rooney. Confused me there for a minute, Ed. Joining us for this segment is Steve D'Antonio, who's the chairman and CEO of a company called Color Me Beautiful, Inc. What is Color Me Beautiful?
Peter, we're a cosmetics company. We're a cosmetics company that was founded around the concept that there are certain colors that a woman looks good in, and that was based on a best-selling book, Color Me Beautiful, that was published in the early 80s. And from that book, we came up with a concept where individuals could define their best colors based on their hair color, eye color, and skin tone.
So it was started in 1986. How big or small is the company today?
We're about 15 million today.
About how many employees, give or take?
125.
Wow. And so you've been in the cosmetics business all your life, and you just decided to team up with this person?
No, that's not the case at all. I was a military brat and then a military officer, then went to business school, and then went to McKinsey, which is a management consulting firm, and then met Carol Jackson, who wrote a big, big, big bestseller called Color Me Beautiful. And it was the book that took what was intuitive and made it an analytical way of selecting the best colors, blouses.
How did you meet her?
I met her on a flight from New York to Washington, D.C.
And so on that flight, this idea got hatched?
It got hatched that there could be a business to this.
Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, several months later, we talked about it. We thought that there could be a business. And several months later, we launched the business. Initially, it was to help to build swatch shopping guides that a woman would take into a store, a department store, and buy a blouse or a skirt and based on already knowing, having read the book, what her best colors were. And then it evolved several years later into a cosmetics company.
What were you doing at the time the business got started?
I was with McKinsey & Company.
So why leave a prospering consulting career to start a business in cosmetics?
McKinsey's a fabulous place and a lot of fun and intellectually stimulating. At the same time, I wanted to run something. And here was an opportunity that just seemed like there could be a lot to it. The book was well known, so the name, Color Me Beautiful, was well known. So I thought with some business experience that I'd be able to do something with it.
What surprised you most about starting a business?
Well, I was really quite surprised at how much I didn't know about being in business.
Like what,
because,
for example?
You walk into the business and you're making decisions about where you're going to have the business and where the facility is going to be. And the folks I had worked with were highly educated individuals. Now I'm dealing with folks that have kind of showing up and just a whole different housewives and women in the military where I was a naval officer, they're all men. McKinsey was mostly men. And so there was just a lot to learn, the culture, the thinking, what's important, how to communicate, what not to say, what to say, how to and we're in a cosmetic business. So now we're selling to women. Our customers are women.
So where in your background prepared you to do this on the fly, to learn the business?
Well, I don't think anything in my background prepared me to interrelate with women. You just have to learn it the hard way by getting out there, doing it, be involved, listening, learning, making mistakes, having someone cry because the way I'm positioning things and making mistakes. But you learn from your mistakes.
You were one of the first virtual businesses in the sense that you're really marketing versus hands-on. How did you learn to handle that, I guess, logistics part of it?
Well, that really wasn't that hard because we didn't have the capital to get into the manufacturing. So and the value added was in the marketing. We already had the name. It was being able to figure out where we should sell the product, at what price, how to position it, what's different about us than our competitors. So that was the fun and didn't require the capital. And frankly, the marketing side of it is where most of the margin is.
Steve, you mentioned, you obviously come from a structured background, both as a child growing up and also going to the Naval Academy. You mentioned that in the green room. We keep coming back to where you've got the strong entrepreneurial spirit. Do you think that joining McKinsey, which works sometimes with companies that are reestablishing themselves, et cetera, was part of that role? Was that a stage that you wanted to go through to become that?
Actually, at McKinsey, McKinsey is more of a management consulting firm where you learn a lot of good things working there, and you contribute to much larger organizations' well-being. So whether you're working on strategy or finance or acquisitions or organizational issues, it's really big corporate culture. So I can't say it came from that. I think it was just to get into a business where you can help someone, in this case women, look better, feel better, feel good about themselves. It was a lot of fun, a big marketing component to it. I just felt that there had to be a niche, and it was a fun thing to do. But I don't know where that itch came from, where that enthusiasm for this kind of a career came from.
Well, tell us a little bit about your background. Where'd you grow up?
I grew up my last couple of years in Fairfax, went to a high school here, W.T. Woodson. My family lived in the area. Then went to the Naval Academy, then the Navy, up and down the East Coast.
So is your father ex-military?
My father is ex-military. We did a lot of traveling throughout the world, Germany and South Carolina, Texas, uh-huh. and Japan.
And do you have brothers and sisters?
I have four younger brothers, yes.
So the oldest of four in a military family.
In a military family, and they all went to the Naval Academy.
Wow. What was it like to be the oldest of four brothers growing up in a family that moves every 2 years?
Oldest of five, sorry. When you're six and your brothers are four and three, it's a bit of a pain in the arse. But but as we grew older, we're best friends because we traveled. We became best friends. We were our closest buddies. And we're very close now. And I think our parents fostered that. They pushed that. They encouraged that. So I consider that one of the great gifts.
Where did you really did have to learn how to work with women mm-hmm. on the job because mm-hmm. you had brothers and you went to the Naval Academy, all male institutions.
Right. That was the hardest part of adjusting to a new business.
Talk a little bit about the adjustment. What did you have to learn?
Well, how to be appreciative of what a woman thinks about when she's making a cosmetics choice, or how to even communicate. At the beginning, I'd be talking about profits or about a cash flow, and not enough about, okay, how's this going to make someone's life better? How can this lipstick make a difference? How the importance of an individual's self-esteem and feeling better about herself.
Is there a particular story that's worth telling around a light bulb moment for you?
You know what? It was really more gradual. It was kind of sitting across the table for the first year and realizing we weren't connecting. It was like I was talking about one thing and someone was talking about another, and neither one quite appreciating the value of what the other was saying. But I've got to say, through the business community, my lovely wife and who's not bashful about telling me what she thinks and very good communicator, and the team at Color Me Beautiful, a lot of great women there, and almost all women.
How did you go about selecting your management team in such a different environment?
Yeah, that's an excellent question. When we got into cosmetics, what I did was I went and looked for folks that had experience from companies like Estee Lauder and Clinique and others. But the trouble was that because we were so much smaller and a startup company, we had to find a different way to compete. We had to find a unique way to compete. We couldn't do what Estee Lauder was doing or Clinique or Ultima and expect to do it as well. So the people we brought in, I had to keep moving out. And then finally struck on someone who is really came up with a creative idea on how to do business that really just fit our niche. And when we grasped hold of that, and the difference was, if you're a lauder, you run advertisements on radio, TV, and magazines giving away a gift with purchase. And we were never going to be able to either advertise, have the reach that Estee Lauder have, or have as good a gift as Estee Lauder. So we had to find a different way to compete. And we evolved into a concept where we were created a Mary Kay environment within the department store. Instead of big, heavy advertising, big gifts with purchase, instead we promoted and incentivized our beauty advisors who work in the store to go out and demonstrate the product to passersby so they could win a car or a cruise or jewelry or all kinds of things. And our business then took off. And we won a lot of accolades, and the team came from the cosmetic business, or love cosmetics, or just are smart, or the web designers, or did display design and marketing design for other companies. We just kind of have a potpourri of motley crew, kind of including me.
So why should a business owner, a male business owner, look to put a woman on his team?
Oh, I think females in general are better listeners. They do a good job of the intuitive side, the relationship side, And that's important when trying to figure out what a product should do or shouldn't do. My wife constantly says, as she picks up something that she has bought, says, a woman did not design this. It just doesn't work very well. And it's in the kitchen, and, you know, and so... So not necessarily just in cosmetics. I think females bring a lot of insight into kind of how to work together.
Great. What's the website address, Steve?
www.colorme.com.
Great. We've been speaking with Steve D'Antonio, who's the chairman and CEO of Color Me Beautiful, Inc. I'd like to thank my co-host, David Cooper with the Bank of America, and Ed O'Leary with Buchanan, Ingersoll, and Rooney. Don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, to learn more about our executive leaders. We'll be back in a moment right after this Business Spotlight.
This is Mike Mannion with Sirius Interim Executive Solutions, and this is your Business Spotlight. Today's guest is...
Lynette Spano.
And Lynette, who are you with?
I'm with SCI Consulting.
But you're not here to talk about SCI today, are you?
No, I'm not. I'm talking about the new face of America.
And what is or who is the new face of America?
Well, it's a show that it's in a pilot stage right now, and we're marketing the pilot. It is it's a platform to host, for me to be the host, to talk about subjects and various different topics that affect modern-day Americans that include Hispanics.
So the new face of America is you, but it's also a people group, isn't that right?
Absolutely. There are 50 million Hispanics, documented Hispanics in the United States, and undocumented, we think there might be another 10 million. So it's imperative that there is a platform where from the experience of a Hispanic perspective, that there can be, you know, the stories can be told about the accomplishments, the contributions that Hispanics and Latinos have made here in the United States.
Why is now the right time for this show?
The right time is now because contemporary Latino immigrants came in here in 1985 and 1989. Their children today are 20, 25, and 30 years old. And they all, their language is English. And so they all need a forum, a medium where they can tap into that is spoken again from the Hispanic experience.
Is there a business aspect to this? Is there market power behind this group?
Oh, absolutely. The purchasing power for Latinos in the United States are, they're talking $8 billion in purchasing power. The networks and the broadcasting networks are beginning to realize that it's a market that they've got to pay attention to.
Fantastic. We've been speaking with Lynette Spano of SCI Consulting. She's the founder and CEO, but she's also the new face of America.
Absolutely.
This has been Mike Mannion, your host with Sirius Interim Executive Solutions, and that was your Business Spotlight.
Back, and you're listening to Executive Leaders Radio. This is your host, Peter Schwartz, along with my co-host, Ed O'Leary, with Buchanan, Ingersoll, and Rooney, and David Cooper with the Bank of America. Joining us for this segment is a man by the name of Bassem Mansour, who's the president of Michael & Son Services. What is Michael & Son Services?
Okay. Michael & Son is a plumbing, electrical, heating, and air conditioning company. And in the Washington area, it's actually a handyman and remodeling company as well. We're based in Alexandria. That's where the main headquarters is. But we also have an office in Baltimore and Philadelphia. Baltimore's actually opening next month. Philadelphia, Raleigh, North Carolina, Richmond, and Virginia Beach.
Isn't that a little unusual?
Unusual? I don't think so. It's what we do.
Okay. How big or small are you guys today?
Today we are employing in excess of 350 people, I think. I think a little bit over 200 vehicles on the road.
And how long have you been with the company?
I've been with the company since I was born. I'm the son.
So you're the son portion of Michael.
Actually, the proud son of Michael, yes.
And when did you take the business over?
I took the business over in 1990 due to unfortunate circumstances of my father passing. I was 19 years old, and my father passed at the age of 47. You know, very quick story. Basically, it was a recession, 1990. It was a one-truck operation. I came from, my father were immigrant Middle Easterners, very poor English skills, and we had some financial difficulties in our life. We had to, cars repossessed, utilities turned off, stuff like that. We had to borrow $5,000 to bury my father. So if you're aware of the company, you think that, you know, it was kind of handed to me. It wasn't that way. It was $5,000 to borrow in order to bury my father. And one thing I will tell you, I had a mother and a sister. And it was really important for me to be strong. And I just always remember during the funeral, I didn't cry for the reason of I wanted to show them that I was strong and capable. And all I could think about after the burial of my father and after the mercy meal was just to get to work.
So at 19, that's a hell of a thing. You talk about some quotes in the green room that really influenced you, and two in particular. What are they?
Well, the thing that really kind of got to me as a young guy was Nietzsche, who said, "What doesn't kill you makes you stronger." I mean, that kind of drove me, because as whatever hardships I came across, whatever problems I was facing, I would always tell myself, if I can get through this, I'll be better, I'll be stronger.
How did you find that quote?
You know, I mean, it's a very common saying. It just always, some things just motivate you, some things touch you. I don't know exactly how and when I found it, but I remember when I found it, I just remember thinking that it just kind of fit me.
Yeah. What's the other quote?
Other quote is by Winston Churchill, and Winston Churchill said, "It is not good enough to say you're doing your best. In order to succeed, you must do what is necessary." So kind of basically it says to me that it's just no excuses. Just do it. And that's the...
So start at 19. You took the company over. It wasn't in the best of shape. How does a 19-year-old get the company to be 350 people and 200 vehicles?
Very easily.
How?
You work your butt off.
What were the early days like? Take us through the first couple of years where you were just struggling to survive and cash was probably just scarce.
I'll tell you. 11 years of college. The first year of college was me sending out letters to anybody who pulled a permit. And then from that, I got a job as a 20-year-old kid, a newly turned 20-year-old kid with Pulte Homes, to finish up Penderbrook in Fairfax.
How did you convince them to make the bet on you?
Because they didn't see a 20-year-old kid.
What'd they say?
They saw a hardworking young guy. What they saw, I gave them... I didn't let them see an image of a 20-year-old kid. I mean, Pulte Homes at the time was the third largest home builder in America. And but the 11 years of college was basically me learning all the things in business that I shouldn't be doing.
Right. It's the Bassam School of Hard Knocks.
It's an awesome university. It just costs. It's the most expensive college. People think that George Washington is the most expensive college. It's not. It really isn't. I promise you. It's Bassam. My college is more expensive.
When did you know that you were going to make this work?
I've always known it. I've always known it. I was just never, there's never anything else but to make it.
Uh-huh. You've recently been recognized as a recipient of the 2011 Jefferson Award for Public Service. Congratulations, by the way. Tell us what the Public Service Award is.
Well, Public Service Award was basically founded in 1972 by a Senator Taft and Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis, as well as Sam Beard. And basically, it's a national Nobel Peace Prize for people who do good things in the community or abroad, as far as the United States is concerned. Past winners, notable winners, have been like Sandra Day O'Connor, Lieberman. I mean, the list goes on and on. It's an amazing list.
You're in really proud company. How did you get into giving back?
Well, that's a good one. I've always been generous. I've always had a heart where I always helped out the person who needed help. I just recently started documenting it, and basically, within my company, they actually I was nominated for the local thing, the local award, and I was lucky enough and fortunate enough to be the recipient of the local award. And then once you win the local award, then you get the national award, and you possibly get the national award. And I was also fortunate enough to win one of the 15 or so national awards.
So how does one go about qualifying? What are you doing out there that is considered public service?
Oh, great. We do this thing called Michelson Cares. And Michelson Cares basically is it basically resulted from the recession that happened where a lot of people had hardships. And so we did a lot of pro bono work, like water heaters, electrical panels, whatever they needed. If their panel burnt up and they didn't have electricity in their house and they didn't have the money to do it, and we took care of it.
So why not just write a check? Why touch it personally?
Because if you just give money, it seems I wanted to be a part of what it was. I wanted to feel like I was connected, and I wanted to feel like that I've impacted somebody's life.
Yeah. Do you think some of the hardship you went through as a youngster had something to do with this?
I think my life, I've been fortunate with how my life has turned out. I've been very fortunate with how my life has turned out, and it's just nice knowing that even though nobody necessarily helped me except my mother, who supported me, and my sister who worked with me and stuff like that, it's just nice to know that somebody out there cares about you. My mother was an awesome person. She really had a lot of caring, and she was just a very giving person, and some people don't have that. So I think if I could give somebody feeling like somebody does care about them, it's a great feeling for me.
You have a great story that you relate in the green room. Why don't you tell us that one? Of one life that you've impacted in particular.
This is a recent project we just completed. It was a story about a young kid named Ryan DeVinny. And Ryan DeVinny, basically 2 years ago, was going to West Virginia University when he was outside of a convenience store late one night. And just because he was wearing a wrong team hat, he was wearing an Atlanta Braves hat, some Phillies fans were talking to him. And then one of them hit him.
Yeah, he got beaten up very badly, and he's just mangled.
Well, mangled is a very easy way of saying it. He's basically in an open-eyed coma.
Yeah.
So basically, here's this kid, 20 years old, open-eyed coma, living in his family's house, completely dependent on his father, with no bathing facility. So what we did as a company is we basically finished off his basement and created a massive bathroom where his father could put him in a wheelchair, bring him in, and give him a shower. So we gave basically $50,000 worth of work away for nothing, but it was just the biggest pleasure in the world. We did it all in like a week. So we had guys working there 7 days a week till like 10 o'clock at night. We just wanted to finish it fast.
That's a wonderful story. What's your proudest moment up till now?
Being here with you guys. No, my proudest moment, honestly, is I guess obviously having children and being part of their lives is awesome. But, you know, my mother passed away about 3.5 years ago. Actually, it's close to 4 now, coming up in December. So I'm proud of the fact that, you know, I was able to have my mother see her grandkids. I'm very proud of the fact that, you know, I was able to take care of my mother.
Yeah. If I was interviewing your father right now, what would he say about you?
My father was known for smiling. He was known for smiling. So
would he be surprised at how big you've grown the business?
He'd be happy and proud. I don't think he'd be surprised, but he'd be very happy and proud.
If you had a chance and he was sitting next to you, what would you tell him right now?
Oh, I say, look what we've done.
Yeah.
I say, without you, it wasn't possible.
Great. What's the website address, Bassem?
MichaelandSon.com, and there's no ampersand, so it's A-N-D. Michael, M-I-C-H-A-E-L, and A-N-D. Son. I'm the only son.
Okay.
People say sons, but it's only me.
Thank you. We've been speaking with Bassem Mansour, who's the president of Michael and Son Services and recent award recipient of the 2011 Jefferson Award for Public Service. I'd like to thank my co-hosts, David Cooper from the Bank of America, Phil Horegi with Sabre Systems, and Ed O'Leary with Buchanan, Ingersoll, and Rooney for helping me structure the interviews today. Don't forget to visit our website, executiveleadersradio.com, to learn more about our executive leaders. I'd like to thank you, our listening audience, for otherwise we wouldn't have a radio show. Have a great day. Bye-bye.
Thank you for tuning in. You've been listening to Executive Leaders Radio, the region's premier radio show highlighting local executive leaders. We hope you've enjoyed the show here on Federal News Radio. You can learn more about Executive Leaders Radio by visiting executiveleadersradio.com or tune in next time right here on Federal News Radio. That's executiveleadersradio.com.
WFED Washington, WWFD Frederick, WWWTFM HD2 Manassas, WTOPFM HD2 Washington. This is Federal News Radio, on the air at 1500 AM and online at federalnewsradio.com. The only radio station in the world dedicated to serving the federal executive and government contractor. It's our mission to provide news and information that helps federal managers do their job better and help facilitate the business of government. Federal News Radio talks to the people who make government work to build a sense of federal community, discuss best practices, and explore lessons learned. Every weekday from 6 a.m. to 7 p.m., Federal News Radio interviews federal newsmakers one-on-one to explain how their news affects agencies and contractors. Nights and weekends, WFED broadcasts all the action of Washington Nationals baseball, Washington Capitals hockey, the Navy midshipmen, George Washington Colonials, and American University Eagles basketball. Federal News Radio, 1500 a.m., the Washington, D.C. home of Navy athletics, and your source for federal news.
This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers.